As a literary agent, you know there's only one thing I like talking about more than books, and that's money. More importantly, cash that stays in your pocket. I'm on the lookout for our listeners at all times. I'm combing deal memos and book publishing contracts for hidden ways that writers are on the hook, and that's why we are thrilled to partner with Chime, who's changing the way people bank. They offer the most rewarding fee-free banking built just for you. That's right, built for you, not the 1%. Chime members can benefit from up to $1,150 in annual rewards, fee-free. Direct deposit unlocks the most rewarding way to bank at Chime. Chime is rated 5 stars by USA Today for customer service. That's real humans 24/7. You're not just switching banks, you're upgrading to America's number one choice for banking with a Chime checking account. They're not like traditional old banks that charge you overdraft and monthly fees. And if you're like me and travel a bunch and love premium travel perks like airport lounge access, you've got it. And the 24/7 travel concierge included with your Chime card. My younger self would have loved a fast-tracked airport lounge access. You get 5% cash back on Chime card in a category of your choice, like gas or groceries for your next writer's retreat. You get savings that grow faster with 3.75 APY. That's 9 times higher than the national average. You can even get up to $500 of your pay when you say, "With my pay." They also have SpotMe, which lets you overdraft up to $200 fee-free. Chime is not just smarter banking. It's the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. Head to chime.com/tsnotya. That's chime.com/tsnotya. It only takes a few minutes to sign up.
Chime is a fintech, not a bank. Banking services for MyPay and Chime card provided by Chime's bank partners. Optional products and services may have fees or charges. Stated annual percentage yield and cash back for Chime Prime only. No minimum balance required. Checking account ranking based on a J.D. Power survey published October 20, 2025. For more information on APY rates, MyPay, SpotMe, and travel perks, go to chime.com/disclosures.
Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm best-selling author Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Cece Lira of Wendy Sherman Associates and Carly Waters of PS Literary. Hi everyone, welcome to today's author interview. Today's guest is a writer and campaign producer working with charities and NGOs. The Carriers, her debut novel, was longlisted for BPA's First Novel Award, shortlisted for Hot Escape and the Science Museum's debut Science Fiction Award, and won the Jericho Writers Friday Night Live competition. She lives in the Northeast with her husband and son. It's my pleasure to welcome back Ruth Newton. Ruth, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bianca. Nice to see you again.
So lovely to see you again. We're going to dive into our shared history shortly. Before that, I just want to give everybody an idea of what's in the book. Now, have a look. Ruth and I are holding up two different copies of the book. Ruth is holding up the finished book with that cover. Very attention-grabbing. I am holding up the galley. So for those of you who are always interested in what happens in the back end of publishing, sometimes we get advanced reader copies where they haven't quite decided on the cover yet. And so we will just get a bit about what the book's about. I think my copy is worth more than your copy, Ruth. That's how it works. Galleys cost a lot more. Finished hardcover, so I'm going to hang on to mine. Okay, so just to tell you what The Carriers is about, flat copy, why should you suffer when she can do it for you? Welcome to Eudaimonia, a revolutionary company that can free you from your unwanted emotions, jealousy, grief, heartache. If you can afford expression, you need never feel them again. In your place are The Carriers, women who are paid to process your pain. In a world full of suffering, there is no shortage of demand. But Eudaimonia has secrets. The true cost of your freedom is a carrier's life. Would you let them pay the price? Dun, dun, dun. Okay, so let's go all the way back, Ruth, and tell everybody how you are connected to the show.
So way back when, I'm actually not quite clear on the year, but I know it was before COVID because that's when I started The Carrier. I applied to be on The Shit That No One Tells You About Writing with a different book that I was writing to have my first pages critiqued. I believe I was your first guest. I don't think you'd had an author come in before to have that live critique experience. And it was so brilliant. Even though I didn't finish that book, it was a real like milestone for me to share my work publicly, like speak to people about my work and feel like it was something I could do. And also the criticism of it was useful because it made me really interrogate, like, is this the one? And it turns out halfway through it wasn't the book that I wanted to write, but some of the themes and the thinking behind it very much shows up in The Carrier as well.
Yeah, well, firstly, nothing gets wasted. We say this time and again, you know, you work on that book and it feels like, oh my God, everything's wasted. Mm-hmm. But there'll be things from it, themes from it, perhaps, that you can use that you felt passionate about. Certainly, it teaches you to become a better writer. You were incredibly brave being the first person to come onto Books with Hooks, because anyone who came on subsequently could have listened to previous episodes to know what to expect. And so you just came in really not knowing what to expect, Ruth. So hats off to you. And we enjoyed our time with you so much that we then tried to bring on as many authors as we possibly could. So in terms of your journey to publication, I mean, you've already won all these awards. The book is not out yet. Can you take us through how this works?
Yes. I think it says probably quite a lot about me that I need like deadlines and things to help me work. And so there's lots of competitions out there for unpublished writers where you can submit partial parts of your manuscripts pre-publication and have those reviewed by judges who will then maybe offer a manuscript assessment in return, or just, you know, a celebration of your work so far. So I think I just needed some sort of milestones and validation along the way to feel like I should pursue this. So I basically just sought out any opportunities there were and submitted my manuscript as I went along and used as much feedback as I could get from winning those competitions. And also confidence boost, if I'm honest, to keep going.
That's a really great way of doing it, because the thing is that, you know, we write this book for a year or two. We do it in the void. Maybe we send it to some beta readers, but we are never quite sure how good the work is until we finally at the end show it to somebody. Whereas if you're showing it to people along the way, like you say, you're getting really good critique. You're able to calibrate if you're close enough. Is this how you landed your agent, or is that a different story?
No, so my agent I landed through just going out like the slush pile query letters. But I do think having those wins on my query letter and following your advice of how to write a good query letter really helped it stand out. And a couple of people got back to me quite quickly and they were like, oh, I saw the Friday Night Live, and it was just a marker of something different. So yes, I did this sort of cold outreach, but I had those things on my letter, which helped. And I also would like to say that, like, even if I hadn't won the things or been shortlisted, it still would have been useful because it was a deadline. I think it's being in that mindset as well that just because you don't win doesn't mean that it's bad, because obviously there's a huge amount of people applying, but it's still worthwhile to get that milestone in place, for me at least.
Yeah, definitely. Especially for those of you who struggle with like self-set deadlines, etc. Imposed ones are always more cracking of the whip, so we're more inclined to meet those. So, okay, so after you got your agent, Ruth, take us through that journey to publication. Like, how much did you and your agent work together on editing it before sending it out? Was there more than one offer? I'd love to hear all of that.
Yeah, so once I signed with Megan at Bergstrom Studios, we did another round of edits. Quite rightly, she suggested changing the title from Emotional Transport, which in hindsight, not that catchy, to The Carriers. It is now The Carrier without the S, which is a recent change, but sort of repackaging it more about the women and the carriers than like the concept of emotional transport. So I think that was a really good reframe. And then we went out on submission and it took months like of just tumbleweed and a few like enthusiastic but no thank you messages until Thorne Ryan, who is the deputy publishing director at Bantam Books, which are an imprint at Penguin, got back to me and she said, you know, really loved the concept, was looking for something that was in the sort of severancy, like issue-based with a bit of speculative sci-fi twist. That's what she was after. So it was really good timing. I say it was good timing. I got the call when I was 6 months pregnant. and the call was very much like, love it, but huge amount of work to do, because her remit was like thriller and crime. And if I'm really honest, when I wrote this book, I wasn't thinking this is a thriller. So I wasn't trying to make it fit into the genre of being a thriller. And Thorne was like, you know, if I take this on, I want to make sure it fulfills the thriller genre, so there will be like substantial rewrites. And I was like, fantastic, sounds great. I am 6 months pregnant, so yeah, I will do my best before the baby, and hopefully I will be capable after the baby. But, you know, I wasn't sure how much headspace and time I would have. So we worked quite like quickly on the structural edit before I had my son, and then another round of edits after he was born, copy edits. There was a lot of back and forth, but it was strengthened so much by Thorne's input.
Was there any point it was a revise and resubmit, or out the gate was Thorne like, I want this, I'm buying it, but I'm letting you know you need to prepare for a big rewrite?
Yeah, the latter. It was, I want it if you're willing to do the work, but I didn't have to do a revise and resubmit.
Yeah, jeez. I mean, a book of this caliber, there's just so much that has to be factored in. And then when you go, okay, I also have to change the genre a bit. And you know what it's like when you tweak something in chapter 16, it has like a ripple effect. Yeah. And if you forget about going back to chapter 2, that doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. So that must have been quite challenging, and doing it pregnant.
Mm.
Hats off to you. Okay, so the inspiration from this book, that's so different from the one you pitched us.
Mm. So the inspiration, there's kind of the sort of the moment where I came up with the idea, which was when I was on a long drive for work and there was a lorry in front of me that said international transport on the back. And I don't know if I misread it or if I was just like, you know, looking for things, but I thought, oh, that says emotional transport, or it could say emotional transport. And then I just started making up a story in my head of like, oh, what would it be like if it was emotions in there, and who would they be going to and from? And it came from that word on a lorry. But underneath that, I was writing the other book that I'd shared with you. And that was a lot to do with a woman trying to reckon with her feelings that she'd suppressed, and also her relationships with other people, where she, you know, there's quite a lot of their feelings were kind of like leaking from each other, like she wanted to help. And so there was a lot of the thought, but then transferred into like a kind of more speculative, this, you know, alternative reality space, which actually for me made it so much easier to write about some of the themes that I was finding quite difficult in that first book, because it was suddenly there was like a freedom to like, well, this is something I can now create in terms of a world. And also no one can hopefully mistake the protagonists for me, or like the situations for me, because it's in this like speculative space. So it felt safer to then actually just write a story. Whereas before it felt a bit too close to my reality that I felt self-conscious. And whereas this world felt like something that I could really explore those like themes that I was wrestling with.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes truth, you can land truth so much more in fiction. You know, you can really nail it. Sometimes in nonfiction, you're so worried about this one's feelings or that one's feelings or how people are going to perceive you. That's why I love fiction. I feel like it's a place where I can tell the absolute truth.
Yes.
You know, we're constantly saying bum in chair, this is what you should be doing to be writing. But if Ruth had not been on that road with that truck going past at that particular moment, that whole idea would not have fallen into place. And yes, she probably would have written something similar because she still wanted to use those themes, but that truck was the catalyst. So I know we say bum in chair a lot, but also go out into the world, my lovelies. Go out into the world, eavesdrop in your coffee shops, drive on the highways, do whatever you need to do to be inspired by the world. So that's the first thing. Second thing is the world building. I mean, a lot of this feels so terrifyingly plausible. So you've had to come up with a whole world, how these things work. Was it a case of sitting up front and figuring out the entire world before you dived in? Or was it creating parts of the world as they became necessary?
Well, I thought when I submitted it to the editors that I'd like cracked the world building. Like I had the concept and, you know, I knew how it worked in terms of like the expression process, and this is the rich, like transferring their emotions to a subclass of women. And that felt like, you know, enough. And then as soon as we were in the edit phase, quite rightly, Thorne, my editor, was really pulling it apart. Like, how exactly does this work? Not because she thought that information should be in the book, because it would be overwhelming, but she was like, you need to know, like, you need to know really, like, the details of this science, which sometimes was frustrating because I had to find myself, like, almost saying, well, it's not real, so it's not real science. So surely then, you know, I don't need to know everything. But she was like, no, it's important for the authenticity of the story that you know. So through the edit process with Thorne, I wrote like a guide to expression, which was like really in detail of how everything worked, how it was branded by the organization, what the organization's like messages were versus the reality. So much detail that isn't in the book in any obvious way, but it really helped me understand the world that I thought I'd already built, but in more detail.
Yeah, that's so true. It's like the iceberg principle, right? What is on the page is the tip of the iceberg. You need to know everything below it. Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about the interstitials from the carriers. Were they there the whole time? Or was it, again, something that came later that someone else suggested to you? I'd love to hear how that worked.
So that came about later in the process when someone sort of said to me, oh, that's a really great story, but why didn't you write it from the perspective of a carrier? Like, wouldn't that be more interesting? And part of me was immediately quite defensive, like, well, no, because it's about this, you know, the moral quandaries of being an employer facilitating this process. But it really stuck in the back of my mind, like, oh yeah, wouldn't, you know, I want to hear their voices. It is about them. And at one point I was like, maybe I'll rewrite the whole thing in first person from a carrier's perspective. But A, the thought was too overwhelming. And B, because they're not conscious when this process happens to them, it would actually be quite difficult to do. So, and then I just thought, well, what about if I just had snippets of, you know, different experiences that would allow me to have carriers' voices, but also show like the spectrum of their experiences and hopefully reflect that they are a group of women, but within them there is like diversity of experience and different takes on what carrying means to them and different motivations. Yeah, so that was why I did it. I'm really, really happy with how it came out. A lot of people comment on how much they love the carriers stories, but it was out of slight fear that I couldn't rewrite it in first person. I'm glad I didn't, but it was someone's suggestion that, oh, it would have been cool to hear it from like the whole book in a carrier's point of view. But yeah, this was my solution.
Yeah, because when we start the books, there's a lot of intentionality that we bring to it. And this is a chunkster of a book. How many words is it?
I don't actually know.
Do you have any idea when you finished the document how many words it was?
I don't think it was more than like 90,000, because I had that in mind as the sort of, you know, don't go over that for a debut.
Maybe they got you expanded because it's like 437 pages.
Yeah, I think it's got those blank pages though
blank
as well.
Pages, maybe.
But yes, it is chunky.
Yeah, so like, this kind of book, so when we talk about the intentionality we bring to it, this kind of book, you could have had so many different points of view. It didn't have to be a single carrier or just somebody outside the system. It could have been some of the wealthy people. It could have been maybe someone who used to be a carrier, whatever. So again, like you said, you wanted to write it from a single point of view. What does that do for the story that having multiple points of view would have taken away from or would have detracted from the story?
Well, I think from focusing on Viv and her motivations for joining Eudaimonia, she's not neutral. She thinks she's neutral at the beginning. And I think whilst she's not, in some ways, that's sympathetic as a character. Like, I think you could empathize with the position that on paper, it does sound like it could be a benevolent thing. It does sound like, you know, okay, this is a paid service. Women are getting benefits from it. People are happier and healthier from this. And I kind of need, I think I needed someone in that sort of like rookie position of not, of that is green to what is happening, so that we could learn about the world and hopefully then put ourselves in Viv's shoes of like, well, how would I have done that job if I hadn't have known the truth of what's happening to these women who are working as carriers. And I think it also, it allowed that growth of staying with her over time to go through the realizations with her and hopefully change our mind along the way as she did as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So one character allows you to build them fully. You have a character arc. Who they are at the beginning is very different to who they are at the end. Every time you add another POV character, the amount of time you have or the number of words you have in which to fully develop them and give them a full character arc starts being divided. So it can be quite tough if you have three main characters and all of them get a character arc, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's interesting because it's really, it's got such a great hook. The plot just keeps you turning the pages. It's just incredible in terms of that. But we are also reading to really bond with this character. You know, it's not just like you expect this degree of bonding with the character to be in a more literary novel. And this is a brilliantly written novel, but it's definitely fast paced. It's got that plot. What did you pitch it as? Like dystopian fiction? What was your pitch?
Yeah, I think I originally said like speculative fiction or like grounded dystopia. I tried to avoid the word sci-fi, even though I was shortlisted for that sci-fi prize, but I didn't feel like that was the right packaging for it. So I used words like speculative and dystopian. And as I said earlier, I didn't say the word thriller because that just hadn't come into my mind. But now it's being marketed as like a feminist thriller with a speculative edge, but that's sort of not the main driver for people. And I'm glad it's sort of lost its sci-fi branding, just because as much as I love sci-fi, I think that sci-fi readers could have been potentially a bit disappointed that it's not sci-fi enough. And yeah, so I think it's sitting in the right place now.
It's interesting because you're the second author I've spoken to in the last few months who sold her book as one genre and then edited it into another genre. And it's not really stuff I've been hearing about before. So for our listeners, remember to keep that open mind, but also to protect the vision of a book if you're not prepared to change it to a completely different genre. Just a last question, Ruth, is the research that went into this, like how much of it is sort of inspired by real science? How much is just made a lot of shit up and used big words so that we would all think, wow, there's some basis to the science? I'm really interested in that.
Yeah, I did do a fair bit of research, especially into like the gut microbiome. And I spoke to a gut microbiome specialist who is really interested in the emotional impact of our gut microbiome. And she was great. And she said, this is a really good concept because it's not that far away from what is possible. Like, and even at the moment, she said, you know, people are experimenting with putting their gut microbiome into other people to see if it can help depression and things like that. So the idea that we can alter our interior world like through the microbiome, I think there's enough truth in there that the science felt believable. And then I just did a lot of research around like medical terminology and how like big pharma sort of present their services. But there is also an element of just magical thinking and making things up.
I was very interested the other day to be reading an article on the gut microbiome and how every person on this earth's one is inherited from their mother's 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 mother's, and it goes all the way back. Is that right?
Yeah. And I also did some research about the bacteria you can find in your belly buttons. And there's some really beautiful imagery of the bacteria in everyone's individual belly buttons, which are all complete unique makeups. And there was one man they found that had bacteria that was only like sourced the other side of the world, like on like a glacier or something. And for some reason he had the same bacteria in his belly button, and like just mad stuff that I don't quite understand, but I was like, it's just very interesting to me. And then I also did a lot of reading around the way that trauma impacts the body. So things like the body keeps the score. Like I was turned to a lot of non-fiction texts as well, just as inspiration for how this process might impact people in the long run.
You can see what I'm busy writing. So there I've got your win. There you go. Body says no.
Yeah.
Legacy of trauma and the inheritors. And I think I've got the other one you said here somewhere. So
okay.
And I've been using the same books. Ruth, yeah. Unfortunately, the end of our interview, it's been so lovely chatting with you. I've so loved the full circle moment. Very first person who came on to Books with Hooks as a guest and is now publishing however many years later. Please show us the book again so everyone can see
here
it.
Here we are.
Okay, you so it's now story. The carrier. It was the carriers. It's now the carrier. We will link to it on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you get the book there, you support an independent bookstore and the podcast at the same time. Thank you so much, Ruth. We wish you all
Thank
the success.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
In an age where everything looks the same online, finding ways to express my personal interior design style is crucial to feeling like my space, well, feels like me. I've gone from student to young professional to parent of young kids, and I keep coming back to Wayfair. There's always furniture and home goods that help me express where I'm at in my life and budget while honoring my individual taste. From renovating my bathrooms in our 90s house to updating playrooms for my kids as they grow, Wayfair always rises to the occasion. My Wayfair finds are endless, but one I really loved was a powder room bathroom vanity that was the exact size I needed for a small space. I didn't have an inch to spare, and Wayfair was there. Wayfair has the items you can't find anywhere else and delivers them seamlessly. If you know what you're looking for, and even if you don't, you can use Wayfair's Verified as a shortcut to the good stuff. Their team of product specialists vet everything by hand using a 10-point inspection, testing things like quality of materials, functionality and features, and even how long it takes to build. My newest living room bookshelf is the 65-inch tall arched storage bookshelf with adjustable shelves, arched cabinet, and a drawer, and it was Wayfair's Verified, and I knew the assembly was going to be smooth. It fits my style, my space, and I smile every time I reach for something on the shelf because it's a reflection of how I want my space to look, polished, modern, and functional. I order from Wayfair whenever I have a specific household need, and you should too. With over 20 million five-star reviews, you are not buying blind. See real customers, real homes, real feedback before anything hits your cart. Ready to upgrade your home for way less? Head to Wayfair.com right now to shop all things home and get your space ready for less. That's Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hi, everyone. It's time to register for the next beta reader matchup, with the matchup emails going out on the 8th of September. As per usual, you'll be submitting 3,000 words from your work in progress, and I'll be matching you up with writers in similar time zones and or genres. Many of the beta reader groups turn into writing groups with a lot of longevity, which is always marvelous to see. To sign up, go to my website, biancamurray.ca, and go to the beta reader matchup page. I look forward to matching you.
Hi, everyone. Today's guest writes murder mysteries with history, twists, and perhaps a romance or two. She currently resides in Florida with her two cats, and in her free time, she enjoys reading, traveling, and sharing obscure historical facts she has recently learned. You can find her on Instagram and YouTube at Jackie Reads and Writes. It's my pleasure to welcome Jackie McMahon. Jackie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bianca. I am so excited to be here with you today.
Yeah, we're going to discuss what a full circle moment it is very soon. But first, for those of you who aren't watching on our YouTube channel, I am holding up the book that we're discussing today, The Cloak and Dagger Club. Lovely, eye-catching cover. Really, really dig it. Dig the vibes there. And I'm going to just read the flap copy so you know what we're discussing, and then we're going to dive in. So, inspired by Agatha Christie's Real Life Detection Club, a murder amongst a group of Golden Age mystery writers meets a sweeping second chance romance in this debut novel from author Jackie McMahon. London, 1930. Finally, everything seems to be going right for Lucy Hubbard. Her first mystery novel has debuted with strong sales and glowing reviews, and she's been invited by Horace Hazelmoor, the king of crime fiction, to join his elite group of writers, the Cloak and Dagger Club. Thrilled at the opportunity, Lucy finds herself swept up into Horace's glamorous world at the Ritz Hotel. She's even willing to put up with the inconvenient presence of her former fiancé, Frank Murray, the club's rising star who's on track to eclipse Horace as Britain's most popular crime writer. But when Horace is found with a knife in his back, Frank is named the police's prime suspect. Despite their complicated history, Lucy knows he's not capable of murder. These two mystery writers must race to solve the crime and fight their lingering feelings for each other before the murderer strikes again. Dun, dun, dun. Okay, so let's talk about how you were on Books with Hooks and how this is really a full circle moment.
Yeah, so I was on Books with Hooks, or my query letter was. It was, I think, December of 2024. It was the episode where you had David Joy on as the guest. But it was for an entirely different project than this one, another historical mystery that I wrote set in Regency era Britain. And it ended up that even though that is not the book that I'm here to talk about today, it did indirectly lead to me getting my current publishing deal with Berkeley. After you talked about my query on Books with Hooks, I implemented some of the feedback. It was very helpful, and I ended up querying that book for quite some time. I sent over 60 query letters. I got requests, but no offers from agents. So then in the spring, I guess actually that was the spring of 2024, so the podcast must have been 2023, Berkeley announced that they were going to have an open submission period where people who did not have agents could submit to them for a limited time only. At that time, I was drafting the Cloak and Dagger Club, but it was not even close to done. So I decided I'll just submit this Regency mystery. No agent has wanted it yet, but I have it. It's ready to go. I might as well do that. I submitted that, and then fast forward to October. At that point, I was planning to start querying the Cloak and Dagger Club the next week or 2 weeks later. And I hadn't heard from the open submission period. I figured they probably didn't like it. It's okay. Then I ended up getting a request from Annie at Berkeley, my future editor, asking to read my Regency mystery, the one that no agent had wanted to offer on. And so I ended up sending it to her. 2 weeks later, queried, only sent 12 query letters, got an offer from an agent, and ended up signing with my agent for the Cloak and Dagger Club. Then in December, Annie got back to me saying that she really enjoyed my Regency mystery and wanted to talk to me about it. So at that point, I panicked, you know, as one does. I was so mind blown because I had thought that she was going to say no. Obviously, it had only been like 2 months since she requested it, which is not a lot of time. But in my mind, I was like...
It feels like an eternity, right?
It does.
Time slows down when you're querying and when you're on submission. It becomes this weird thing.
Yeah. And also the thing is, I was always checking the Pub Tips subreddit. And Bryn Donovan, an author who had previously gotten an offer through an open submission period, and actually ended up providing a blurb for my book, so another full circle moment there. She had posted at one point about how when she got the deal through open submission, they got back to her in like 2 or 3 weeks or something like that. So my anxious brain was like, it's been more than 2 or 3 weeks. That probably means they hated it, right? So when I did get that interest through the open submission, I really wasn't expecting it at all. I was so excited. But I also, at the same time, I was like, I don't know what's going to happen now with the Cloak and Dagger Club, the book that I signed with my agent on. And what ended up happening is I talked to my agent about it. My agent told Annie, my future editor, well, Jackie has this other book. They said, that sounds like a great idea. Can we read that? Can we get an exclusive until early January? Which was fine with us because we weren't planning to go on submission over the holiday season anyway. And basically what they ended up telling us is, you know, we really liked Jackie's Regency mystery, but we are all obsessed with this book. We like it even more. So would you like to sign a 2-book deal with us for this book? And that's what we ended up doing.
That's incredible. Again, I love discussing how many different paths to publication there are. because you never know what's going to end up paying off. And even if that book isn't published, you never know what it's going to lead to. So have you put the first book completely aside, and for the second book, they want something completely different? Or is it a case of revising that? What is that going to look like for you?
So the second book in my deal is going to be a sequel to the Cloak and Dagger Club. It is with my editor currently, and that'll probably come out sometime in the summer of 2027. After that, we'll see what happens. My editor has let me know that if someday I want to revise the Regency mystery with her, she would be very open to that. So it's not currently in the works right now, but definitely something that may be pulled out of the drawer in the future.
It's so great to have those options and to feel like, you know, I always say that the book that's in the drawer was the book that taught you how to be a writer, but it is lovely if you feel like, you know, that'll also get published. So let's first chat about the inspiration of this. You said that your father said to you, "Shall we have a drink at the Ritz?" And that sort of got the dominoes going. Will you take us through that? And also Agatha Christie's Detection Club. I didn't know about that. So take us through all of that.
Yes. So in my book, the Cloak and Dagger Club is a crime writers club in 1930s London. And in my book, I say that they meet at the Marie Antoinette suite in the Ritz in London, which is a real place. And the reason that I picked that location is because I went with my father on a trip to London. We were eating at an Indian restaurant right around the corner from the Ritz. And as we're walking back to the hotel room, he said, "Oh, oops. Let's pop into the Ritz for a second to have a drink." So we sat at their Art Deco bar, had some very expensive martinis. And that I then used for the book because I had been there, I had taken in the ambiance, and it felt to me like a place really steeped in history, and also a place where I felt like a lot of classy writers would hang out in their free time. So I have to credit him for that part of the story. Then the original idea came from this group called the Detection Club. It was founded in 1930, though actually today it still exists. It is still a real group. And I have been a really big Agatha Christie fan since I was around 14 or 15 years old. I'm currently on a mission to read every single Agatha Christie mystery ever. And I just happened to discover, while going down a Google history rabbit hole as one does, that she had been a part of this group called the Detection Club. The original president of it was G.K. Chesterton, who wrote the Father Brown mysteries, and the original idea for the group is credited to Antony Barclay, who was another popular writer of that period. He would invite other crime writers over to his house to have dinner with him, and that's where the idea kind of came from. So it was basically a group where a bunch of popular mystery writers would get together a few times a month or a year. And the 1930s and 1940s are known as the golden age of crime fiction because of how popular it was in that time period, particularly in Britain. So when I heard that some of the most popular authors of this era were all together in this club, that to me was a really compelling idea. Because I thought there was so much potential in having all of these people who know about fictional murder being together in one place. What would happen if all of those people had to deal with an actual real murder in their midst? How would they use their knowledge as crime writers to solve the case? So that is what the original idea was born out of.
I love that. Now, taking it to the next step, because we're always discussing intentionality on the podcast. So you could have made this exact story and just given it a modern twist. It could have been modern day crime writers meeting at the Ritz, right? So I know that like the 1930s was the golden age of this, but why specifically in terms of plot, in terms of characterization, did you choose to base it in 1930 as opposed to modernizing it?
Yeah, so I wanted to keep the historical setting because I really wanted this book to be a sort of murderous love letter to the history of the mystery novel and have it take place during this specific period in history where the mystery genre was really flourishing into what it is today. So what you'll find when you read the book is that it has a lot of meta in-book references to mysteries, how they work, popular authors from that classic period. And so that is really integral to the book and what I wanted to do with it. It really is a murderous tribute to mysteries as a genre. I also personally just adore historical mysteries, and I just can't get enough of them. I love so many historical mystery series. The whole reason that I wanted to become an author of historical mysteries is because I first read the Veronica Speedwell mysteries by Deanna Raeburn, which when I read those, I was like, this has every single thing that I love in one book. It has mystery, it has history, it has romance. And I'm really glad that I am working with Berkeley, who is one of, in my opinion, the best publishers for historical mystery. So the decision to keep that classic setting was really born both out of my personal loves as a reader and a writer, and also to have that ability to really explore the history of the mystery itself.
Yeah, and also, you know, when you base it in the 1930s as opposed to today, obviously, you know, their technology was very different, right? So being able to use certain things to figure out who people were, they didn't have them. You don't have to deal with cell phones. You don't have to deal with like a whole bunch of things as well, which, you know, can really elevate the tension in a story as well. So let's discuss the first 90 pages, I think. I think I counted 90 pages, all take place in one day. And that's extremely challenging to do, to keep up the tension and pacing, to keep us like in one place with one group of people and take up 90 pages, really challenging. So take us through like how you structured that. Was that always the case? I'd love to hear the evolution of that.
Yes. So the book always started in the same way. The book begins with Lucy, my protagonist. She's just been invited to the Cloak and Dagger Club for the first time. So she arrives at the Ritz, gets to meet everyone. And there is a bit of conflict because Frank, one of the other club members, is her ex, and he had no idea that she was invited to the meeting. And the reason that I really wanted to start in that moment was to really get to know who all of the characters are. I do also think it can be really helpful for world building if in your story you are able to make the main character someone who is an outsider to a place or a group, because then you are able to have the character discover that location, all the other characters, along with your reader. They are coming at it with a fresh perspective, just like your reader is. I wanted readers to be able to understand the characters and the inner workings of the Cloak and Dagger Club so that when the murder occurs, they really understand the politics and dynamics of all the members. And then Horace, who is the president of the club, and it says on the back, he's the one who gets murdered. He is someone who everybody in the club has an opinion about him, and he has ruffled a lot of feathers. So you really get to understand all the reasons that all of these characters would potentially want him to die, the way that he rules the group like a despot. I also think that having a mystery novel where the events are coming quickly one after another does really heighten the tension, because it gives it that sense of urgency if you're writing a mystery that takes place over a shorter time period. In other genres, you can easily write a story that takes place over months or even years, but when somebody has been murdered and you need to find out who is responsible, there is that sense of immediacy. A murder mystery has some of the highest stakes of any genre because this is literally a matter of life and death. Somebody has been killed. Is the person who killed them somebody who is at risk of potentially hurting more people? Are more bodies going to fall? And also, if we don't catch the real killer, who is the one that is going to have to take the blame for this? So I think developing things over a shorter time period, it really does heighten the stakes and the urgency to figure out what's going on here.
Yeah, a whole bunch of things that I want to unpack there. I love what you're saying about the protagonist as an outsider. So, you know, for our listeners, when somebody is an insider, they're not going to be describing necessarily how somebody looks because they've seen them every single day for the last however long. They're not going to explain the setting as much. They're not going to have this kind of interiority and reactions to things because you'd be going, oh, this feels like it's context for the sake of the reader, as opposed to the character themselves are finding all this out for the first time. And so we get that sort of outsider's view of that, which I really love. Can you tell me in the Agatha Christies, because I've read Agatha Christie, but like not, you know, not as closely, obviously, as you have, at what point, like percentage wise in her books, does the murder generally occur?
Yeah, I think it sort of depends. So Death on the Nile, which is one of her most famous mysteries, nobody dies in that book until it's 50% of the way over. And then the last 50%, you know, the bodies start dropping throughout that. I think it does maybe take place somewhere around 25%, which is about where my murder takes place in my book. She doesn't typically start with a body on the first page. It does give some time to introduce the characters and their relationships and then have the murder occur, which also I personally prefer that because for me, I like to know who the characters are before the crime occurs. I remember when I was preparing to query, I saw a video from a literary agent where they said, hey, if you're querying me with a mystery or a thriller, somebody better be dead on page one, yeah. Which is that person's preference. I personally need to know who I'm reading about first because I want to understand what is at stake here. I want to know who that person was. I want to know what are the ramifications of this person being killed for the other characters. So I think, yeah, Agatha Christie, usually somewhere around 10 to 25%, though sometimes as late as 50%.
Yeah. Yeah, it's encouraging to hear because I've also heard a lot more that editors, etc., want the murder to happen earlier, or at least they want a prologue that kind of flash forwards to the murder. But like with my book as well, with The Most Puzzling Murder, I also had the murder happen quite late because for me, it was very important to set up all those dynamics first. So yeah, so for our listeners, you know, be intentional with where you place it. If it's going to come later, make sure that you are setting up all those dynamics, etc. first. If it is on the first page, then the stakes need to keep getting raised from there. So just be aware of that. So let's talk about introducing a lot of characters who are all doing the same job. They're all writers, you know, mystery writers, and you introduce them quite quickly because, you know, she walks in and she has to meet all of them. For you, how was your approach to differentiating them beyond their physical descriptions? Because it's really important for the reader to know, okay, this one's this, this one's that.
Yes. So I very much intentionally thought about who were some of the popular authors of the 30s and 40s? What did they write about? What are some of the enduring mystery tropes that have lasted through the last 100 years that mystery readers know and love? So very much intentionally so, when I was thinking about who are the kind of people that are going to populate this group, I thought about the different types of mysteries. So, for example, one is a mystery that follows a professional detective or a police procedural. That is a very enduring trope. And so one of the characters is a former detective who now writes a police procedural that is somewhat based on his own experience as a former Scotland Yard detective. There are also a lot of cozy mysteries. You can think about the Miss Marple stories and her very quaint English village that has a disproportionately high number of murders, or the Father Brown mysteries by G.K. Chesterton, the first Detection Club president, which are about a member of the clergy who is solving murders. So those combined in my mind to have someone write a more cozy series where the main sleuth is a vicar. And so I really wanted to make sure that we were representing all these different types of mysteries and thinking about, okay, who are the different types of people who would write different types of mysteries? I do think when you have an initial idea for a story, one of the things that I like to do is take that initial idea and think, okay, who are the different types of people that we would potentially have in relation to this idea? And just write a list, the first things that come to mind, the different types of personalities that you would have that fit the promise of the premise. So I wanted to make sure that even though they're all writing mysteries, they're all writing different types of mysteries. And the types of mysteries that they're writing, they also tell you something about them, because the person who writes a really cutesy cozy is not going to be the same as somebody who writes a hard-boiled, you know, noir-esque police procedural.
Yeah, I love all of that. And I love the idea of starting off with, you know, with the premise and then going, okay, who would be the people that would populate the premise? And that can evolve with time, obviously, but it gives you a better sense of things. Also, what you do is that you write multi-POV even in the same chapter. So what we're generally used to seeing is one chapter is from this character's perspective, one chapter is from that character's perspective. But even in one chapter, we get to see the story unfolding through multiple characters' perspectives, which, if done wrong, can feel muddling because you're like, whose head am I in right now? What's going on? So again, can you speak a bit about that approach and that intentionality?
Yes. So I always have really liked reading and writing multi-POV stories. And initially, when I first started drafting this book, I was actually having a hard time with that because I was trying to figure out, you know, whose head should we be in at every particular time? And sometimes feeling obligated to bring in a certain character, like, oh, we haven't heard from so-and-so in a while, so I should do something in their head. But I think when you're actually writing a multi-POV story, you shouldn't put pressure on yourself to make it an even split or to follow a set formula. It should be thinking about who is the character who it makes the most sense story-wise for us to have access to their thoughts at this particular moment. And so I did sometimes have multiple POVs in one chapter, always, of course, with a clean break, an indicator that we are going into someone else's head, because obviously you do not want to be head hopping, and that really disorients the reader. And then they're like, wait, why am I now in this person's head now? I was just with the other character. So there are still very clean breaks and transitions. But what I did is I allowed myself to not necessarily follow a set formula, not necessarily be keeping a running tally of, okay, well, we've been in Lucy's head this many times and we've been in Frank's head this many times. Instead, I was following what felt organic to me and the character who I felt like was going to best serve the story at that point. So I do think we spend a lot of time in Lucy's head, my protagonist. She is somebody who we follow a lot of the book. I think Frank, the love interest and the sort of deuteragonist, we spend a lot of time in his head. And then the other characters, we pop in as necessary when, for instance, it's now at a point in the text where that character and their secrets are of particular note. That is a good time to include their perspective more. There's also, I believe, one part that we're in the perspective of the detective who is assigned to the case. And that is the only part in the entire book where we are in that character's head. But I chose him for that moment because it's a part where the murder has just occurred and all of the characters have to be interviewed about it. So I chose that moment to present the characters the way that this detective who has just come onto the scene sees them. So I think the thing about multi-POV is you need to work it out a little bit. Don't necessarily pressure yourself to make everything even. And for each moment, just assess what it is that you are trying to accomplish with that scene and what character's perspective is going to help you the most in that purpose.
Love that. Okay, we've got time for like one more question. So I love the interstitials. So we've got excerpts from characters' books and stories and newspaper articles and invitations, etc. Can you speak a bit about how each of those help move the plot along as opposed to just being there because you like them?
Yes. So the point of having these mixed media elements in the book is to not only tell you something about the characters, because like I said, all of the characters have different tropes and the books that they choose to write tell you something about them, but also to complement and highlight the emotions present in the book at that time or what it is that the characters are doing. So each one of them is meant to pull out specific elements of what is happening at that point in the book rather than just being a cool thing. And I actually wrote the entire draft. Then after I had done the draft, that's when I wrote a lot of these book within a book elements. So I did it retroactively after I already had the complete draft so that I could pinpoint the right points to put those in and plan the excerpts around what I was trying to achieve.
Love that as well. Right. So Jackie, thank you so much for joining us. So many insights to be gained there. I'm holding up the book again, The Cloak and Dagger Club. If you buy it from our bookshop.org affiliate page, you support an independent bookstore and the podcast at the same time. Jackie, we wish you so much success with this.
Thank you, Bianca. I was really happy to talk with you today.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.